The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Willie Fallotton. He joins us on the telephone. Where are you? Are you in Oregon?
Yeah, Scappoose, Oregon. Oh. And I apologize if there's a buzz on my side because I live in the country and there's just nothing I can do to figure that out.
No worries. You're out in the middle of nowhere, aren't you?
No, I'm just like 5 miles out in outside of the town and in the woods, and it's hard to get good internet, and the phone buzzes.
Nice. Hey, well, here you are, and I had you on a couple years ago for your book, The Horse, which I absolutely loved, and you've got a new one out. It's called The Left and the Lucky, and when I talked to you about The Horse, I remember you mentioned that you used to do a lot of house painting, and I'm guessing that informed you and inspired you to write the story in a way.
You're right. You know, as like a struggling musician, I just worked in warehouses until I was about, 30, early 30s, and then, and I had to quit jobs all the time. I'd go on these tours where I wouldn't make any money, and then, but I'd have to quit the job. And then come back with no job. And so this buddy of mine was a house painter, and I started painting for him for, I guess, like 7 years or something like that. And I had my own little business. Yeah, it was just because that way you didn't have to keep quitting. You just finish a job and then go on tour, and then you didn't have to quit all the time. But, you know, I grew to like it enough, it wasn't much of a job.
Well, you just mentioned your tours, and our listeners are going, tours? What kind of, are these book tours? What kind of tours are these? I guess we better tell them about your other job.
Yeah, I was in a band called Richmond Fontaine for 23 years, and we were like a small-time kind of country punk band, and we toured around, and so when you tour, your bosses never understand, and no one understands. I didn't even understand, and so you end up quitting a lot of jobs, going on the road, and during that whole time, I just wrote novels for fun, from say 18 to 35 when my first one came out. It was like my hobby, because the band, being a band, I wrote all the songs for the band, and so when the band would get beat up or no one liked the band, I'd feel so guilty, I guess, and responsible that for fun I just wrote novels that, I didn't really show anybody or tell anybody about it, because I didn't want people to think I was bad at that too, so I just kind of hid it, but that's how a long-winded way of saying that's how I became a house painter. And you're right, I wrote kind of about the jackassery of all the guys you work with when you're a house painter.
And your previous book, The Horse, was inspired in a big way by your songwriting, because your protagonist in that story is kind of a failed songwriter. And in this new one, we meet a guy named Eddie Wilkins and his neighbor, a kid named Russell. And wow, these two, we just fall in love with them. Tell us about these guys.
Well, yeah, Eddie's, a 42-year-old house painter that's going through a divorce. His wife has left him. He runs a painting crew of, kind of misfits and derelicts. And he's a really steady guy that I think is, as you'll find out in the novel, he's had some rough knocks in his life. And so he can't say no to kind of broken people, like kind of busted up people. He kind of just takes care of them, kind of is their lifeline. And you know, where the left and the lucky, where the lucky comes in is this kid and his brother and his mom move in to a house next door to Eddie, and the kid's really struggling. Russell, he's 8 years old, and he's been getting kind of beat up by his older brother. His family life's kind of imploding. He's a pretty beat up, lost little kid, and he just happens to live next door to the perfect mark, you know, the perfect guy to kind of take him under his wing. So it's just basically about you know, the luck of meeting the right guy at the right time, I think. And so Eddie kind of gives the kid hope, you know, to keep carrying on, and they develop a kind of friendship. And you know, Russell, the little kid, develops a friendship with his whole crew of, you know, derelict house painters, you know.
I love the character Houston. I'm guessing you knew a few Houstons in your time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Houston is, I mean, that's the one fun thing about working those kind of jobs is the kind of guys you meet. They literally make you want to drown yourself sometimes, but they're always funny. And so, yeah, Houston's a loveaholic and an alcoholic, and he's probably, you know, he's a little manic. He's a very sensitive guy and a pain in the ass, but also really funny. And then you have Cordero, who's, you know, like the you know, just a serious blowhard, delusional blowhard.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I spent most of my life around guys like that. And so for fun, you know, I put that in there. But, you know, the bigger idea was the idea of, Russell's house, I always thought of as black and white. Russell, his home is so stark, and it's like a noir movie. It's full of shadows and darkness, and it's very bleak. And when you're in those kind of situations, I think you realize you start to think there is no color. There's nothing but this kind of like noir darkness in your life, and it'll never end. And then just right next door is like Technicolor. It's just guys living their normal life, but there's great humor and love and hope and just daily life with these house painters. And I think when Russell, the little kid, starts hanging out over there, he starts realizing, like, hey, life can be really funny, and there can be adventure. There can be adventure even, you know, if you're painting houses all day. There can be great laughter and joy even in day-to-day life. And I think I was really interested in that idea of how you can get so lost in darkness if your home life's bad.
Mm. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Willie Vallotton. We're talking about his new novel, The Left and the Lucky. And Russell, when they initially move into that house, they're moving into his grandma's house, and they've kind of taken it over. His mom, Russell's mom, she's had a tough life. Can I say what her occupation is?
Well, of course, yeah.
Okay, she's a stripper. And then there's the older brother, Curtis. And he's hard to like, but as we go along, we realize this poor kid has had a rough time.
Yeah, I was really interested in, you know, like those, that's where the other half of the title is, the left, like those left behind. You know, I was really interested in, there's a quote by Primo Levi that basically says, you don't know who's strong until they're tested. Like, you don't know which person has, say, true grit in them and until they're tested. And it could be, I always say the same thing, but it's kind of where I got the whole idea for the book, which is if you went to, say, Safeway and you took five random people and say one's like a yoga instructor and one's in like an old lady with an emphysema tank, like an oxygen tank, you have Russell, and you line them up in a row and you say, who of you can really handle like hard mental anguish or hard physical pain? And it might be the old lady with emphysema pulling around an oxygen tank. You don't really know who's really got it in them. And I was really interested in that in regard to the two brothers. You have Russell, who's very weak. You know, he still wets the bed. He's kind of a compulsive crier. He doesn't really have any friends. He's in a really bad home situation. And then you have the older brother who's handsome and strong and has friends. But like so many young men, he's filled with rage. How he deals with stuff is rage, and how Russell, the little kid, deals with things is to chess move his way out of it. And you're right. His mom is a stripper. You know, when I moved to Portland in the 90s, there was like a strip bar on, you know, every other block. There was a strip bar where I lived. It was just a strip bar culture in Portland, Oregon back then. And I think when I wrote the book, I kind of thought of it back in the days when I was painting. And yeah, you would it's changed now, but there literally was like in my neighborhood like 5 strip bars within, you know, a half a mile radius.
Wow. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Willie Vallotte, and we need to take a quick break here, Willie. And I pulled a song out of your CD. If you could introduce this, we'll let you take us into the break. Tell us about this song. It's called "Delauded Diane."
Well, you know, the record, my band, the Deliants, we put out a record called "The Setup," and it's really, you know, influenced by the opioid epidemic, which really hit Portland so hard. All of a sudden, it was like a plague of people suddenly sleeping on the streets, young people living in tents, living in cars. And it was so dramatic and so frightening. And then also so like, what do you do with these people? Like, what do you do with such a huge spike in opioid addiction? And so I think it started seeping into the songs I was writing. So Delauded Diane is about, you know, a woman that, you know, grew up, you know, playing clarinet in a marching band. She loved to swim. She ran cross country. She loved French movies. And then she gets lost to addiction. It's a pretty heartbreaking song about that. In a way, it's kind of a Deliants doo-wop kind of number. It's us really stripped down song, but it's always been one of our favorites to do live in the last year.
Nice. Here are the Deliants. Thank you.
car and 63 bucks. The guys don't think she'll make it back, but I know inside she still has enough.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. This is 91.3 FM, introducing you to your new favorite song. And hopefully we just did that a moment ago, going into the break with the new album by the DeLines. It's called The Setup. And we've been joined by Willie Vallotton on the telephone out in Oregon. He's got a new novel out. It's called The Left and the Lucky, to go along with this new album. And you wrote that song?
Yeah. I've been a chronic songwriter, you know, kind of since I was 11 years old. So I write all the songs in the DeLines that they're singing on, I write. And Corey Gray, the brilliant keyboard trumpet player, he writes a lot of the instrumentals on the setup. And he's just a genius. And so his instrumentals are really beautiful.
Yeah, the horn arrangements are gorgeous. Really impressive.
Yeah, he's really good, you know. We had just started the band, and a friend of ours named Jenny Conley was the first keyboard player, and she was in a different band that was touring, and she goes, I can't go on this tour with you. And so through a friend, we met this guy, Corey Gray. He's a brilliant keyboard player, and we start touring with him, and then we didn't even know he was like an amazing horn arranger and trumpet player. And so as the band started touring more and then putting out other records, you know, we've really kind of moved towards his skill set, which is you know, the horns, and he can arrange horn strings, and so I write songs just thinking about his horn arrangements on it. So it's really fun. He's a really cool guy and just brilliant.
Sweet. And we were talking before we went on the air, you mentioned that there's a companion CD for The Left and the Lucky, is that right?
Yeah, when you buy the book, there'll be a QR code in the back, and you can download a soundtrack. And you're right, that Corey and I wrote all the songs on it, and they all kind of reflect the Left and the Lucky, both the humor in it and the sadness. It's all instrumentals except for a couple spoken word pieces and one song called "When Marlene Was Marlene" that Amy sings.
And that's Eddie's estranged wife.
Yeah. It's a song back when she was in love with Eddie and had her act together. It's a song for that era in her life.
Yeah. Marlene, she's another one. It's kind of heartbreaking character. And when the book opens, when we've got Russell living with his grandma, she's kind of his refuge. He goes into her room to hide out from Curtis so Curtis doesn't beat him up, and this is where he can escape. And when he's in there, bless her heart, we really feel for her, but we can tell there's something wrong with her. For one thing, all she does is eat candy, and it turns out she's got some cognitive problems, and she ends up having to move into a facility. And this is another thing that kind of forces Russell to go spend time with Eddie. And I love their exchanges, because he'll come over there, he'll show up at Eddie's place at the end of the day, and he'll go, "Have you got some brushes I can clean?" And Eddie will go, "Are you hungry?" And Russell will go, "I am if you are."
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think I was interested in that idea of, like, that Russell's, he's a pragmatist, and I think he sees this as his only option is to hang out with this house painter. And the house painter, one thing about Eddie, is a workaholic. He works 6 days a week, probably like 10, 11 hours a day. And so every time he sees a kid, he kind of like goes, "Oh man, now I got to hang out with this kid." But he starts, you know, Russell's a likable kid, and so he starts liking him. But, you know, yeah, he can't, he doesn't get a moment's rest. He pulls his painting van up, and then he sees a kid there, and then he's got to, you know, hang out with this kid. And I think through Russell's perseverance that way. You know, he kind of sways Eddie into, like, taking care of him, and then Eddie realizes what a cool kid he is. But, yeah, it's a you know, Russell doesn't give up easy.
Well, Eddie's a rescuer, but a reluctant one. And it depends upon what he's rescuing. Now, if it's a decrepit old car, that's different.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think Eddie, as you learn later in the novel, you find out why he collects strays. I mean, his wife is kind of a beat up stray. His the guys he hires are kind of strays. Russell's a stray. Everyone around him, I think Eddie can't say no to people. And you find out later in the book why, but I think, yeah, he's a workaholic who, his wife leaves him. And so he's thinking of things, what can I do at night? And he sees this old, derelict, you know, 1968 Pontiac Le Mans. And, he thinks, oh man, maybe that's something I could do at night instead of thinking about my ex-wife. And the crazy thing is that exact story happened to me. I was painting this really fancy kind of historical register house with a crew of guys, and they were hoarders. Like, it was that weird thing, like, you never know what's inside somebody's house. And on the exterior, it was a really fancy old house. It was like an architectural, you know, jewel. And inside it was full of dirty dishes and dirty clothes, dirty underwear laying around, mold of that people would leave food on the stairs. I mean, it was frighteningly, it was kind of horrific, really, like that people would live in this condition. And we would have to go into the house to, you know, unlock windows and stuff. But anyway, I was up on a second story scraping paint. And then, you know, you're like half the day, you're like, should I just jump off and call it a life, or you're up there daydreaming? And then I would be up there looking around, and I saw this old Le Mans on another street, and I got obsessed with it. And it had flat tires and dust covering it, and I started leaving notes on it saying I wanted to buy it. And then finally, you know, after weeks of kind of half-assed looking around to who owned it, I got obsessed with it, and I made a grid and knocked on every door in the whole neighborhood until I found this weird kid that owned it. And then I spent 7 months calling him until he finally said, I'm broke today, you know, you can buy it if you want. And so that's how that story got in the novel.
Wow, that's pure autobiography.
Yeah, that part really is.
I love it. And it was the same kind of car?
Exact car. That was the exact car. Yeah.
Yeah. What happened to that car, man?
Oh, you know, I kept it around. I put a kill switch in because being in a band, I put kill switches in everything so no one would steal it. So I'd always have these secret switches in the car so you couldn't start it. Like if you tried to steal it, you couldn't start it. And I did that, you know, as a touring musician in you know, bad Econoline vans. And then I did it with muscle cars. I was obsessed with, you know, Dodge Darts for a while, and I had kill switches in all of them because they're so easy to steal. But, you know, it just started rusting out. And then, you know, I started doing better in life, and I started driving cars that had air conditioning and heaters that worked and didn't break down all the time. And I was like, holy hell, you know, you don't have to have a squeegee, you know, like in the Northwest, it's so wet that you're driving with a squeegee to get the dew off the inside of the car on those old cars. And so I just sold it because it was rusting out and I was broke, you know.
Wow. Okay. Well, when you read the book, listeners, you'll discover how Russell knew how to use that kill switch. And that's pretty cool. That's one of my favorite parts of the book, what happens then.
And again, I think it shows you, like, he's a really smart kid. He's a survivor. He's the guy Primo Levi was talking about. He's the guy that seems the weakest and frailest, but yet he's the guy that can handle the true hardships of life.
And you give Houston a lot of the best lines. There was one where he refers to a chain gang, and I just couldn't stop laughing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I used to... I mean, for a while, Houston took over the book. I think I cut 170-odd pages of Houston out because, he's like a fungus, man. I mean, I could like once he starts going, like I couldn't stop him. And he took over the book a bunch of times. But yeah, I love him. I mean, I used to have an employee that he only worked like part time for me, and then I'd pick him up in the morning, like Houston, and he'd be so drunk and hungover. And I go, "Why are you so drunk and hungover? You knew we were working today." And he goes, "Well, you're a pushover, Will. I knew you wouldn't. You know, what are you going to do? You can't yell at me." And so I stayed out all night. And so I've worked with, like, in particular, a couple of Houstons that were like so maddening. But then they'd make you laugh. And sometimes that's all you need is a guy to make you laugh when you're doing jobs like that.
Well, I can certainly see how he could take over the story. And I kind of got a sense when you talked about how you had much more Houston in there that the parts you cut out were probably before Russell goes looking for him in this epic quest to try to locate Houston, because Eddie really needs Houston to help him out. Eddie, like you say, he's a workaholic, and he's got these jobs, and Houston needs to show up for work, but the man is elusive. And Russell, we really admire this kid for what he does.
Yeah, I think it was that fear, you know. I mean, I think once Russell starts spending more time at Eddie's, he's like I said earlier, it's like all of a sudden he sees that there's color in life. And he starts having all these old, you know, kind of ragged house painting men befriend him and be really, they're really nice to him. They really like the kid. He just becomes another part of the crew to him. And then I think when Eddie gets overworked and Houston goes missing, he tells Russell, like, you're going to have to spend more time at your mom's house. You know, you can't be over here all the time because I'm going to be working all the time, and I don't want you staying at my house alone. And I think that panics Russell, like his new life's falling apart. He's scared that he's going to have to go back into the black and white and the darkness of his own home. And so he goes on this quest to find Houston, who's gone on a self-destructive bender. And of course he finds him, and because he's Russell, he doesn't give up.
I love this guy who's hanging out with Houston, but we'll let readers. Oh man, that just cracked me up. This has got a lot of darkness in it, as you say, but it's such an uplifting, such a fun book. I love these characters. We need to take a quick break here, Willie, but I want you to introduce another song and take us into the break. And here's the one I picked. Tell us about this one. It's called "Can You Get Me Out of Phoenix?"
Oh, yeah. God, that was a rough one to write. I must have rewritten that song 14, 15 times, because it's a beast of a song. It's like a long kind of story song, but really it's about like the daughter of a lifelong grifter, and who ends up herself kind of a grifter, living in, and she gets stranded in Phoenix, and she's kind of reminiscing about her life and her father and kind of her situation, because when we meet her in the song, things have fallen apart. And she's begging for somebody to get her out of Phoenix. So, yeah, I wanted that big kind of country soul feel. And Amy sings so well on those kind of songs, those big kind of like sultry ballads. But, yeah, it was definitely one of those harder lifts that actually worked out. Usually when a song gets that hard, I call it you throw the kitchen sink at it. You throw everything at it. You start putting horns on it. You put strings on it. And you put banjo on it. You put whatever you think you can think of to put on it to save it. And then usually they are the most expensive songs, and then they never make the record. but this was opposite. I rewrote it and rewrote it, and then the band did it pretty fast, and it just started working. So I'm glad you picked that one, because it's one of my favorites.
All right, here we go. It's the DeLines from the new album, The Setup, and it's called "Can You Get Me Out of Phoenix?" on WYSO.
Mm-hmm.
can't take it here another week. I just gotta get my car fixed, get myself together, and get out of here. Can you get me out of Phoenix? I should have listened to what my dad told me. He said, keep your own ladder, 'cause when you're down, everyone will just sit by to watch us sink. Trying to play as it lays, but ever since Billy got killed, I've been struggling. It don't mean it's easy to change, just 'cause one day you wake up and what was working ain't working. Tell you my dad died in his car, had a heart attack in Lee's Liquor parking lot. A row of $1,000 suits hung from a backseat pole. In his trunk was everything else he owned. Underneath the spare, we found 20 grand. My mother took the money and put his ashes in the garbage can. But later on, I got mine. She told me there was no use fighting what was in my blood. Nothing she tried could break me. I told her her and her boyfriend's trying was what made he and I the same.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Willie Vallotton has joined us on the telephone. We're talking about his new novel, The Left and The Lucky. We just heard another track from his band, The DeLines, from The Setup. And do you time your book releases with CD releases, or is this just a coincidence?
It's a coincidence. You know, we were doing one tour of the UK that I just got back from last week, and but we decided, we'll make a road CD, a road record, and we'll call it the setup of just kind of oddball. I thought it was kind of an oddball collection of tunes, but people seem to really like it. Like all the like our manager and our record label and all that really liked it, and they're like, no, put it out as a full record, and like a real record. And so that's why they lined up, landing on each other, because it wasn't supposed to be that way, but the record just kind of, I guess, made its way into the world in a bigger way than we had imagined. But usually I try to separate them, because it's a lot going back and forth on it, but it's also really fun.
Well, you've put out a lot of books at this point, and you've been getting a lot of recognition for your books. I see you got a nice blurb from Joe Hill, Stephen King's son.
He's a cool guy. I love his books, and he and I have become kind of pen pals. He's a really cool guy.
I had him on the show a number of years ago, and he's kind of a tough interview.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's kind of tough, but that's okay.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I've interviewed some people, and it's hard when they're just yes, no. And you have like 30 questions, and you're just, you know, you've talked to them for 10 minutes, and you're on like question number 24, and you're like, oh no, I don't have any more ammo to throw into this conversation. Those are always tough.
You're saying you were interviewing someone else?
Oh yeah, man. I've interviewed a lot of people doing book of answers or whatever, and then, you know, I learned a long time ago to have a serious amount of questions, because once in a while you'll be doing a book event and they'll just answer with yes or no or just kind of shrug, and you're like, man, we still have 45 minutes up here, man. Yes, help me. Uh-huh. And then, I'm not great at it, but I've done a lot of like in conversation stuff. And I interviewed for the local paper. I used to do interviews of musicians. Like I interviewed Dave Alvin once. And he was a big hero of mine when I was a kid. And I remember he was kind of like, I just had woken him up or something. And he was pretty like yes, no, and that was when I learned, you know, that you got to have a lot of questions for the yes and no people, or you just end up, you know, sitting there with a lot of dead air.
That was on the phone.
Yeah.
When I was the music director here, I did an interview with him, and he was great. I loved it.
Oh yeah, he's great. I was pretty green, and I was too much of a fan, I think, too. I think I. You know, I was like a little puppy dog, a little bit.
You were into the Blasters?
Oh, yeah, man. I grew up, when I was 13, my brother moved to Los Angeles. We grew up in Reno, Nevada. And so my brother moved in 81 to Los Angeles and started sending me home cassettes and records of the cowpunk scene, the Paisley Underground scene as well. So Los Lobos, the Blasters, X, Rank and File, Green on Red, the Long Riders, all these kind of cowpunk or, you know, country influenced punk rockers. And I mean, it changed my life. I was writing songs by that age. But when I heard all that stuff, I was like, oh, you can be a kind of a weirdo and like folk music too. You don't have to be a redneck to like country music, because I grew up with country music, but those were the guys that always tried to beat you up, and you're like, you know, I didn't understand the difference between the fan and the musician back then, and so I fell madly in love with Los Lobos and the Blasters and X. I mean, they became I could barely complete a sentence when I was a kid without talking about those bands.
So you literally nearly got into fights with country people?
No, but the guys that were like the least open-minded guys that I grew up with and hung out with on a daily basis were like Hank Jr., Merle Haggard, David Allen Coe, just like those kind of guys. And they hated punk rock, and they hated anything kind of weird. And, you know, I was always drawn to that stuff. And so I always equated those guys, you know, with beating up guys like me. And it wasn't until, you know, I was always a big Willie Nelson fan because Willie's always been kind of my personal saint. And he helped me through a lot of hard times as a kid, his records, because he was so open-minded and he could navigate the rednecks and he could navigate anything, it seemed like. But where my life changed with country is a guy got me out of, I was a sophomore in high school, and he got me out of a class one day and took me to the library and played me Kern River by Merle Haggard. And he said, see, he was a really cool guy, and he goes, see, Merle Haggard's cool. Listen to this song. And after that, Merle became, you know, one of my favorites.
Wow. That's a great story. I love hearing that stuff. My guest is Willie Vallotton, and we're talking about music and we're talking about literature. And let's talk about some of the recognition your books have gotten. Have some of these been adapted for other mediums?
Yeah, they've made three movies. The Motel Life, Lean on Pete, and The Night Always Comes have become movies. So I've been really lucky in that regard. I mean, I always felt with publishing novel, you know, how I got published is a fluke. The whole thing's a fluke, except I always really liked writing novels. So I've been really, really fortunate. I always feel like, you know, I always feel like I got invited to a party I wasn't supposed to be invited to, and then you just don't want to get kicked out of it. So the second, you know, I got a book published, I just kind of like put my head down and just tried to work even harder than I was working. Because, you know, I'll be a janitor at the party or wash dishes at the party, but I don't want to get kicked out of the party. And I don't want to go back to being a house painter, you know.
Uh-huh. And you just came back from a tour of England with your band. And now, as we are recording this, tomorrow's your publication date for the novel. So probably your last kind of quiet day. Are you doing any publicity? Are you going out and doing any signings or anything for this?
Yeah, you know, like tonight I'm going to Powell's with the, you know, the kind of iconic bookstore in Portland. That's just an amazing bookstore. I'm doing an event there, and then I'm on Thursday I'm going to Spokane and I'm doing an event with Jess Walter. I don't know if you've read his books, but he's talk about really funny. He can stick the knife in you, but he's really funny, and he's one of my favorite writers. He's just a brilliant guy, and I'm lucky enough to get to do an event with him on Saturday, and then I start doing book tour. I do a kind of a run through the South. You know, I love the South, so
wow.
I'm excited to do that.
So this event with Jess, is this going to be one of these ones where you interview each other? How's that going to work?
Yeah, I think it's going to be that. I think we'll be talking a lot about the Left and Lucky, I think. But we'll, you know, of course, talk about him. And his So Far Gone, it's his latest, and it's brilliant. I'm just rereading it now, it's just brilliant. But, yeah, I mean, it's scary because, you know, he was a journalist, and he's, you know, he's no dummy. So I'm going to have to, you know, get my little lawnmower of a brain working in top condition that day to hang with him.
Well, you mentioned you've done all these interviews with different people, and it sounds like a lot of them were in bookstores where there's two authors sitting there and one of you interviews the other as part of the event. Which one of those writers was the toughest to interview for you? Were you just like in awe, or you just ran out of questions, you didn't know what to say?
I mean, there's been a few where sometimes I guess the hardest one was also the most fun, which is Barry Gifford. Barry Gifford's a brilliant writer. He's a buddy of mine, but he's also a big hero of mine. You know, I started reading him at, I think I was 21. And, you know, back then I'd never even met a real writer. I didn't go to MFA school. I didn't know anybody really that even liked reading novels. And so when I interviewed him, he's really, really sharp. He's got like a perfect memory, and he's no fool. He's a sweetheart, but he doesn't suffer fools. And I remember doing an interview with him, and I'd made a couple mistakes on dates of when he put out books. And he'd go, it wasn't 1985, it was 1984. And I'd be like, oh damn, I'm in trouble. But, you know, he held your hand after he let you know, like, all the mistakes you made. He's a sweetheart. But I think it was a combination of him being too smart for me and me being too big a fan. That was tough. But he and I became buddies because of it. And he's one of my favorite writers and one of my favorite people. I just admire him. And that's obviously the tricky thing with interviewing people you really admire is you get really scared. You're nervous and you put a lot of weight on yourself to not mess it up. So,
well, Willie, I really admire your work. Thanks for your time today.
Oh, thanks for talking to me. I really appreciate it. And thank you for reading The Left and the Lucky.
My guest has been Willie Vallotton, the new one just coming out, and also the new CD. And we're going to fade out with an instrumental. And this is how you close out your new album by the DeLines, The Setup. The tune is called The Last Time I Saw Her. And this is a pretty one. Thanks again, Willie.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Thanks for listening.